Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Dave P. from San Diego.
Dave, alcoholic.
Hey.
And I just felt it. I got some good instructions before the meeting on how I'm supposed to do this. Thank you, my lovely wife Debbie, for coming down with me, and Joey for riding with us. Joey's the one that gave me the instructions. I'm going to try and do good. I have it in my mind that I'm not going to swear, but that's probably not going to happen. I'm going to do my best, but in order to get the point across, you're probably going to have to hear a little bit of colorful language, but I'll do my best. Thank you, Larry, for asking. Larry left. I got up here and Larry left. Larry asked me to speak, and I'm grateful that he did that. you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has it saved my life, and it's an honor to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to kind of do it in sections here. And I may ramble a little bit, but I'll try and stay on point. There's Larry. Happy birthday, Larry. Happy birthday to everyone that took 4 years. That's weird. that is bizarre. And to the 90 token, congratulations. I'll get to that in a second. Thank you, bud. I'm an alcoholic, dude. You got a bigger one? Okay, so the first time I don't know the first time I drank. My parents used to have margarita parties, and I was really small. I was less than seven, and I got to work the blender, and there was always a little slush left on the bottom of the blender, and that was mine. And nobody ever said anything. After it was discovered that I don't drink well, it was pointed out to me that my first word, besides like mama and dada and no, was booze. And the reason for that, and this is going to give you an idea of how I drink, the reason for that is, I don't know if they still do this, but when I was cutting teeth, my parents used to rub whiskey on my gums. And now I'm cutting teeth. I'm tiny. And I can remember the squeak. Yeah. When you rub booze on your gums, it squeaks. And then it gets warm, and then it feels better. And I like feeling better, because I feel like shit all the time. I do. And the reason I felt like shit all the time is because I didn't know this at the time, but I have a spiritual malady, and so I didn't know that then either. I know that now. So the first time I got drunk was I was 7 years old. Between 7 and 8, somewhere in that range. And the cool thing to do, I'm from Minnesota, and the cool thing to do was to go on the weekends to a roller rink. So I had these, they're much bigger than this, but I had these two plastic bottles. I don't know what they were from, but I rinsed them out, and I put tequila in one and triple sec in the other one. Is that still a margarita? I don't know. So I had these two different kinds of booze, and I was drinking this stuff at a roller rink, and I got caught, and all my friends who I was letting have drinks, they knew we were together, and they all got in trouble, and so after the big, I was banned for life from that roller rink. So there was a big meeting. Am I whispering? So there was a big meeting at my house. Because I was the troublemaker, and all the parents came, and we're all sitting around a room, like in a circle, And seems like my chair was separate from everyone else's, but it probably wasn't. And at some point, one of the parents asked if anyone, meaning the kids, thought that there was a problem here. I raised my hand. As far as I know, I'm the only one in that group that's in AA. But I also knew that if I raised my hand, maybe the admission of guilt would lessen the consequences. So I got it going. I got the game down. So there's not really a lot of social occasions for children under 10 to drink. I'm going to touch this a lot because it's really weird having this on. But I found them. I found excuses and raided liquor cabinets and did all that kind of stuff. So I was 12 years old when we moved to San Diego. My whole family moved out here. And I'd never seen any kind of green leafy alcohol or anything like that in Minnesota. And when I got out here, that was easier to get a hold of than booze was. It was a pain in the ass to get booze when you're 12 years old. You know, you got to get the guy hanging out in front of a liquor store. He's got to get it for you. Sometimes he doesn't come back. or he wants more than we told him he was going to get out of it. And so I started doing other stuff to make me feel better / treat my alcoholism. And I don't know, it says in our book that somewhere we crossed an invisible line. I have a feeling that if a bunch of people would have locked hands and drawn a big, bright yellow line and said, "Do not cross, Dave," and told me everything that was going to happen to me if I drank, I'd have knocked them all down and jumped across. Because I fucking love... I love being drunk. I don't like drinking. I love being drunk. Yeah, is there like a volume? Because I don't know if I'm... Am I whispering? I'm not trying to whisper. I love being drunk. So I start getting in trouble right away. And the deal is, like I don't realize it at this point, but like I can't not. You know what I mean? I have to have it. And the progression for me was smoking a little, drinking as much as I could, to daily. Really quickly, before I was even in high school, I was drinking and getting loaded daily, and I went to school the first day of my junior year to pick up my schedule, and I didn't go back until the day before the second semester started, and the school called and wanted to know if I was actually enrolled at this high school. And unfortunately, my dad got a hold of the phone and found out what was going on. And I went to school the next day, and I went to all my classes the next day. And my second period was English. And when they were taking roll, she said my name, and I said here, and the whole class went like that. And she said, "You're David Prenat?" Yeah. And she said, "Could you come with me, please?" And they didn't want me in that class. I'd been arrested just before that on campus, and they didn't really want me in the advanced English class. So they made me sit in the back room and read books all by myself. And so for a week, maybe a week, I was hit or miss on whether I showed up. And I got really, really drunk one morning before school. Really drunk. And I walked into the guidance counselor, his office, And I said, I'm dropping out. Now, I wanted to drop out, but I also wanted someone to, like, give a shit enough to try and talk me out of it. Does that make sense? He said, absolutely. And he opened his drawer, and he pulled out a thing, and he started filling out the paperwork, and I was done. I was out of school. So I had to, I got a job, and now I missed a really important part in there. I got locked up in a mental institution right before that. My mother asked me one time if I'd ever thought about hurting myself, and I was offended that she even asked me that, and I said yes. And when I got home from ditching school that day, there was a little duffel bag packed for me, and I went to a place. I don't think it's still around. It was called Villa View, and I was not on the alcohol and drug treatment side. I was on the you can't have your own scissors side. I'm 7 years old. I'm banned for life from a roller rink. By 17, I'm locked up in a mental institution. And when they let me out, that's right before the first part of the semester. So that kind of makes sense now? Okay. So I was supposed to go to meetings. I was supposed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And the psychiatrist that was assigned to me, the day before I got out of the hospital, he called me into the office and he said, so how do you feel about getting out of the hospital? And I already know how to play the game. I know how to tell people the right thing. And I said, you know, I'm really kind of scared about getting out of here because I think I might drink again. And he said, I'm going to get close to the mic for this. He said, you may not be an alcoholic right now, but if you have one more drink, you will be. And that guy went to school, right? So, the only way, I didn't like him, the only way that I could prove this idiot wrong, anybody? I had to drink alcohol to prove him wrong, and then my life turned to shit, and I came to AA, and everything's good. Yeah. So I got out of the hospital, and then I got the phone call, went back to school for like a minute, and the guidance counselor told me he wanted me to meet someone. And he introduced me to this guy, Paul. And Paul was the only other person in Patrick Henry High School that it was known who was sober. Not who didn't drink and do drugs, but who was sober. And we hung out for a little while, and we kind of cruised around to meetings. And my experience with coming to meetings, period, is... There's power in these rooms, and I could come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, like a lot of them, and I could postpone the next drink for a while. And I knew that you guys were talking about steps, and I knew that you guys were talking about God, and I knew that you guys were talking about service, but like I got like 30 days, and I already felt better. I was sleeping, I was eating, I was hydrated. And I wasn't hungover. I hadn't thrown up in weeks, and I didn't really see the point in like digging up a whole bunch of stuff that that was embarrassing and painful, and writing it down on a piece of paper because that's stupid. So the steps. My case obviously was different because I was already feeling better and I didn't have to go through all of that stuff, right? So I would hang out as long as I could. And now I've told you a little bit about my, I don't drink well at all. But the time would come when having a couple of beers, just a couple, wasn't a bad idea. And I didn't know what that was. I had no idea what that was, even though I'd been to AA before. I had no idea what that was. And I don't have any experience in having a few beers more than once and having my life not turn to shit. I have no experience in that. But in our literature, it talks about being insane. And there's the cliche thing and repeating the same thing over and over, expecting different results. But I am insane when it comes to alcohol, when I'm sober. I knew for a long time that once I start drinking, I drink until it's gone, or I drink until it's taken away from me, or I drink until everything is gone. And but when I'm sober, I'm separated from alcohol. I have not had a drop in me, and I haven't had anything else in me. I can't keep myself from taking that first drink. It seems sane. And I'm pretty sure that it's not going to happen like it did last time. Because I've been sober for 3 years. I've been dry for 3 years. There's no way that an alcoholic can be dry for 3 years and not take a drink. So I must not be alcoholic. So, over and over and over again, I repeated that experiment. Over and over and over again. And I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous with my ass whooped. That's two. And about 99% convinced that I was in trouble. And I would see. Now I've been out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's say I've been out for 3 years drinking, and I would come back, and I would usually like gravitate towards it. Is that me? I would usually gravitate toward the same meetings. And I would come in, and I'm all shot out, and I'm homeless again, and I don't have any money, and I look like shit. Three. And these same old guys would be there. And they would be in the same seat. The same chair. And it used to drive me nuts. It just drove me out of my mind. And they, oh, hey, Dave, welcome back. How you doing? You want my phone number? You have a sponsor? And I'm like, dude, I've been drinking for 3 years and you haven't even left this room. I don't want what you got. I don't want what I got, but I know I don't want to be the guy in the same chair for year after year after year after year. And so I'm getting loaded really hard and as much as I can. And I met this woman and just like took my breath away. And she's getting loaded too. Right? That works out good. And I remember thinking, you know, if I'm ever going to have a shot with her, I gotta knock it off. I have to stop doing propellants. I have to at least moderate my drinking and only smoke really good weed. That's probably about as sane as I could get. And it was awesome at first, you know. We're in love and we're getting loaded and it's like, loaded love. And then the wheels are falling off and the rims are sparking and it all turns to shit. Four. It all went really bad. She booked and I booked and she was down at this place downtown and I was sleeping on the floor at my dad's house and she knocked on the door one day and she was sober. She was going to meetings and she was sober and she took my breath away again. So I followed her. Because I'm either taking a hostage or trying to. So So I followed her, and I slept on a loading dock and in a park downtown this is really cool. It was called The Apartment. It was 6 stories underground in a stairwell underneath the big Bank of America building downtown. That's where I slept. And it could be raining outside, and I didn't get wet, and it didn't get hot in there, and I slept down there for a long time, and then I got into St. Vincent de Paul, which is where she was. And now we're sober. Sober love. And that was good too. That was really good too. So we're living down there and we're going to meetings and we get this whole host of friends, you know, all these other homeless drug addicts and alcoholics, and we're all hanging out and we're tight. And we're not going to be a statistic. We're not. And she got drunk. And I followed, because that's what I do. I'm not real good at it most of the time, but I'm going to do my best to protect and to drink all your booze and to get validation. That's what I need. So now we're both loaded again. And then boop, we're sober again. Several times we're doing that. And then one of us is sober, and then one of us is drunk, and then we switch. And I've been working at the same job for a while, and she was working at the same job for a while, and we had a place, and we had a couple of cars, and we were doing pretty good. And I was drinking on the weekends. I was only doing a little bit of other stuff, small amounts on a semi-regular basis, but drinking on the weekends. And then we're both loaded again all of a sudden. We'd stopped going to meetings. We'd stopped hanging out with our sober friends. And I wasn't taking any steps again. So we're both loaded again, and it's really bad. Really, really bad. And right before the whole getting loaded thing, I was roofing, and I fell off a tile roof, and I landed straight up and down on my left leg, and I broke the back of my tibia off. And we were a week away from this is a trip. We were a week away from closing escrow on our first house. So I'm in the urgent care, and they've taken X-rays. I haven't called her yet, and they took the X-rays, and they do like a front and a side or whatever, and the front looks like a good knee. And then he popped the other one up in the little backer light thing, where it's a profile, and there was like this rad, like pointy jagged thing, floating way off where it wasn't supposed to be, So I called the realtor first. I told him, you got to get me out. And then I called her, and she was there, and they sent me home, and that was a whole big thing. But they gave me Vicodin because they said my knee was too swollen to operate. The guy that said one more drink, I was an alcoholic, and this first knee doctor that I went to, both idiots. So I'm sitting in my chair with an ice circulator thing around my knee, and I'm eating handfuls of Vicodin and handfuls of Tylenol PM. I'm not drinking, but I'm eating pills, and I swear there was no conscious thought in me to take Vicodin to get high. All I wanted to do was pass out because my knee hurt really, really bad. So I'm eating these things, and this guy that I worked with, he came over one time, and he brought me a 6-pack of Diet Pepsi, and he brought himself 2 tall boys of Budweiser. And then he came over again, and he only ended up getting 1 tall boy. And it was off, I was off and running. It took 1 beer to set me in motion. So... She's drinking, I'm drinking, we're doing other stuff, and I got, that was in February of 2000. And I think August, I got almost $40,000 settlement money. Awesome, right? I'm set. I'm good. And they've been giving me the, like, this little pilly ass, like a quarter of what I was making when I was working, like as from the settlement, you know, until everything was cleared. So that was in August, and now I'm smoking really good stuff, and I'm drinking Heineken, and I'm drinking Jägermeister. I got a big one in the freezer, and and I'm thinking this is going to be good. This is going to be good. And I still can't work. I'm immobile. I can't work. So I can drink, and I can do the other stuff, and I can treat my alcoholism all day long. Plus, people feel sorry for me. By Christmas, the Christmas after that August, I don't think I'd paid rent once. Her new car and my new truck were both repossessed. Anything that we could plug in was gone. The electricity was turned off. We were being evicted. And I was running the lamps and occasionally the TV on car batteries hooked up to inverters. Now, if you've been in Alcoholics Anonymous before and you've gone out and drank and you found out what I found out, it's miserable to have a little bit of knowledge of what alcoholism is and then to pour a bunch of booze on top of that. It's really not a good drunk. And so I'm sitting in this apartment, and there's a cooler that has now natural light in it. And I remember I used to check my own couch cushions because people would still come over, you know, and I would check my own couch cushions for change so I could get a 12-pack of natural light. So we're all, there's like a bunch of people in this apartment. I don't know any of them, but they're all in there, and it's really dark, and there's nothing good going on. And there's like six or seven lighters up in the air, you know, and it's like reflecting, and it's kind of weird. Some of you know what I'm talking about. And I heard AA in my head. Now, I was hearing a lot of stuff in my head, but this was like stuff that I heard in meetings, and I heard seeking lower companionship. I'm like, look at these losers. And then the sobering thought, the moment of clarity, those other six, seven losers were seeking lower companionship, and it was me. And that was a little disturbing. So there's really nothing left, and our plan, my wife and I's plan, was to, we were going to go to a house owned by a church somewhere in Arizona. I don't even know where it was. We're going to go out there and we're going to dry out, and I don't know what I'm going to do out there. I'm going to sweat, I'm sure, and like pull weeds or something. I don't know. But it's all set up. Her son is an ordained minister, and he set this up for us. So, we have a little, one of those little Toyota front U-Haul things, and there's a bed. I don't have any idea what else is in there, and there was two cats stuffed under the front seat of the van. And we're going to Arizona. We're going to get sober. We're going to go to Arizona to get sober. And I lived in El Cajon, right by Parkway Bowl, on Cuyamaca right there. And the sheriffs came right when they were supposed to, and They asked me to leave. They let me get the second cat. That's all they would let me get out of the apartment. They let me get the, because I couldn't catch him. And I got him, and he went under the seat. And so we're going to go to Arizona. We're going to dry out. And I don't know. You already know that I didn't know what city it was in. I don't know if we had a map or an address. I don't know if we had any of that stuff. We were just going to drive east, and hopefully they found us. I don't know what we were going to do. So now Arizona's east. I live in El Cajon. I made it all the way to 70th and Alvarado. That's the wrong way. If you're not familiar with East County, that is the wrong way. And this is when it happened. I'm loaded. I don't know how much I'm on and what it was, and I'm drunk, and I come out of one. I come out of a blackout, and my wife is on her back on the sidewalk. And I'm the one that put her there. And I shattered. I shattered inside. And the startling realization, the moment of clarity, the that moment broke me. And she got in the U-Haul and hauled ass, and I started walking up 70th, and what happened is my sister and her boyfriend, they were moving in really tight little circles, and they were living in a little tiny, like 18-foot trailer up on El Cajon Boulevard. And they let me in, and I lay down on the floor. And when I could, I called one of those old guys that was sitting in the same seat in the same meeting year after year after year, and he still had the same phone number. Worked out good for me, right? And I remembered it. It wasn't written down anywhere. I remembered this guy's phone number. So I called him up, and he goes, okay, I'm not going to sponsor you. He'd offered several times, and I always said yes, but I never did anything. He said, I'm not going to sponsor you, but you can come and sleep on my couch, and you can use my phone until you get into 10-day or detox. So that's what I did. I got over there, and I slept on his couch. And I used his phone, and I went tried to get into detox, and there was like two days, three days, something like that, where I just laid on the floor and cried and shook, and was really sick. I was really, really physically sick, and so we went down to detox, and this guy's name was Gary, who was volunteering down there or whatever, and he came out to talk to me, and I go, man, I'm really messed up. I got to get in here. I'm willing to do whatever. Please let me in. I don't have anywhere to go. And he goes, well, when's the last time you had a drink? And I said, it was like 2 or 3 days ago. And he goes, oh, well, you're probably detoxed. We can't let you in here. But I can recommend you for the 10-day program. Now, that 99.9% convinced that I always was before had I got that last little bit. I'm 100% convinced now. I'm broken. I'm powerless. I'm hopeless. I'm a mess. So I offered to be brought in by a black and white. I will go get drunk and have the cops bring me. Will you give me a mat if the cops bring me? He goes, well, you know, I appreciate your willingness, but we don't have to do that. And I knew that they wouldn't let me in if I, like, grabbed his skinny little neck and ripped it apart. So I went back and I slept on the couch and I made phone calls until I got in a 10-day. While I was in 10-day, I didn't know where she was. And I was in 10-day for I don't know, 5 or 6 days, something like that. And we were outside smoking a cigarette, Rollies, and the U-Haul goes by. And she's in it. And I saw her, and what I saw was... But what it was... And she kept, and she didn't stop. She kept going. So now I'm like, I'm sobbing. At least I know she's alive. But I'm sobbing, and I'm thinking she laughed at me. She thinks I'm a loser. She's with someone else, blah, 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 right? So they put me in this room, and two people sat with me and just watched me just like vibrate and shake and cry. Well, what I didn't know was that someone else had gone out and talked to her. She didn't laugh at me. She didn't point at me. She wanted to talk to me, but there was no parking. So if you crossed over this little line, this little fence thing, you lost your bed. And it was absolutely 100% my intention to cross through the gate and lose my bed because I had to find her. And I didn't. I believe that was absolutely divine intervention. It was told to me in that little room that I was no use to her if I wasn't sober. And that wasn't much of a consolation, really. That wasn't much of a consolation, but it was all I had. And I stayed, and I got out of 10 Day, and she went into 10 Day, and George showed up at a meeting one morning, and I was standing outside. She was going into 10 Day, and his sponsor and I were friends for a long time when I was in out of AA. And they introduced me to George, and he called up to the Freedom Ranch in Campo, and he said, "Hey, I got this lop here. Danny knows him. He's a mess. What do you want me to do?" And they told me to come the next day, and they gave me a ride up to Freedom Ranch. And they spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous up there every day. I got AA every day up there. And then my plan was is I was going to get enough money by raking dirt and whacking weeds to get an apartment and come down and get her, and we were going to be fine. And after 105 days, I had like $7. So that wasn't going to work out, and they offered me a chance to go down and fill out an application at Pathfinders, and that's what I did. No other choice. And so that's what I did. I went down there, and I lived at Pathfinders, and she got into a program. And I got offered a full-time job, a $500 car, and a place to live all like within a week, and I didn't make it happen. I was just like present and doing what I was supposed to be doing, and all that stuff kind of happened all at once. So I got to Pathfinders, and it was strongly suggested that I get a sponsor and take the steps. Very, very strongly. Now, I had already taken the first step, shattered. The second step, call that guy, literally, like that's step two. I need help. And whatever it is, I don't care what it is. I need help. And I took the third step up on the rock at the Freedom Ranch with a guy. And I've been brought up in a religious. I went to a Lutheran like elementary school, church all the time, chapel, Bible study, this, that, all that stuff. So I had this. Had a knowledge and I guess a belief in something, but when I took the third step up on the rock and I walked down that little path, I was crying, and all of the stuff all of the stuff that I learned in books didn't matter, because I was like I couldn't really like surrender to that. And when I did the third step up on the rock, all of that stuff, that prejudice and that closed-mindedness and all that stuff fell away. And when I got to Pathfinders, I got a sponsor, and I continued to take the steps. And my wife and I are together, and we love each other very, very much. That's not possible without me being sober. It works way better when she's sober too. But we have no shot if I'm not sober. And the what's happened right before that first drink that I was telling you about, I'm going to wrap it up here real quick. Right before that first drink that I was telling you guys about, when I got banned for life from that roller rink, my grandfather killed himself. Now, I'm little. Well, that's why that happened, and that's why that happened. He killed himself, and at first I didn't know that. All I knew is that he was in the hospital, and then my mother came home, and she was crying, and she said, "Bompa," which is what I called him, "is with Jesus." And then a couple days later, I overheard my dad on the phone, and he said, "Self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head." I'm just a little guy, but you lied to me. You lied to me because I'm not worth telling the truth, and he wasn't willing to live because I wasn't a good enough little boy. I took the steps, and I found out that that's the old idea. That's the lie that I've been living with. And my grandpa was kind of my hero, right? He was a big guy. He probably wasn't bigger than me, but when I'm little, he seemed like a really big guy, and he had this really cool laugh, and he played the harmonica, which is super sexy. And I used to follow him around because, like, my grandma and grandpa used to babysit me when my parents were at work. And I used to follow him around the house. And he would go to the refrigerator. And he had one of those aluminum, 16-ounce, whatever they are, those old, people are in here are old enough to remember those aluminum cups, right? And he would go to the refrigerator. I'm going to turn my back on you for just a second after I lead up to this. He would go to the refrigerator, and there was a big bottle of vodka in there. And he would fill the bottle of vodka, or fill the glass all the way up. And I'm standing behind him, and he would drink the whole thing, and he would go like this. Then he would pour another one, and he would go sit down. And when that was gone, he would go in, and he would pour a full one, and he would drink it. And he would pour another one, and he would sit down. I understand this. That's what booze does for me. I don't have to have a couple drinks in me for ease and comfort. I only have to be on my way to the liquor store. I don't have to have any other substance in me. I only have to know it's coming. And I get relief. I get ease and comfort. I know that relief is on its way. There's a lot of new people here. And I didn't manage my time well at all. The steps have absolutely changed my life. And they've given me, what they've done is that lie, that idea about myself, the steps allow me to not believe that anymore. And not believing that anymore, they've allowed lots of room, because that took up a lot of space. They've allowed lots of room for God to get in there and bless me and make me comfortable almost all the time. And I was really angry today. Nothing went my way. I knew I was going to speak, and I had the script, and I didn't tell anybody what it was, and I got a flat tire, and I called the customer, told him I was going to be, I told him I have a flat tire, this is where I am, do you want to reschedule? And what she said was, "No, call me back when you get it sorted out." What I heard was, "I don't give two shits about your time. You get here as soon as you can." I'm a little screwed up still. I haven't had a drink in a while, but I still don't necessarily hear what you say. So it's really important for me to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be honest with people in Alcoholics Anonymous about what's really going on with me. And I hope that you find someone that you can talk to. I hope that you get a number. I hope that you've been here a couple times and you see some old fucker sitting in the same chair again, and I hope that you get their number, and I hope that you find what I found. Thanks.